Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I'm chatting with designer and lettering artist Jason Karn. We talk about how a love for metal music and album art led to an interest in design, how Lettering Library came to be, and how he finds the books that make up the library. How he almost quit design altogether after being burned by a series of bad clients. And how he turned things around, all right after this. I talk about Jack Prince on the podcast all the time, and today isn't any different, except that I want to talk about how much we rely on them at Creative South. Not only has Jack Prince been a longtime sponsor of Creative South and the podcast, but they help us with so many cool things every year. Whether they are making our pop-up displays and tablecloths, or printing our notebooks, Jack Prince is always there when we need them. They even printed my Creative South podcast stickers that have a coupon code on the back that gives you a great discount on all of their products. Speaking of stickers, Jack Prince will print any kind, shape, size, stock, including full-color stickers with full-color liner prints for you to use as product labels, promotions, bumper stickers, hang tags, business cards, and more. Right now, you can get 500 3x3-inch die-cut stickers starting at $149 when you visit jackprince.com. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. At Creative South, we love Astute Graphics plugins. Astute Graphics have developed 16 popular and innovative plugins for Adobe Illustrator, leading the way in imaginative tools for vector designers that significantly save time, boost creativity, and achieve amazing results. Popular plugins include VectorScribe, Phantasm, Vector First Aid, Mirror Me, and more, all of which come with a free 14-day trial. Go ahead and give them a try. Astute Graphics currently have 25% off the full Elite Bundle, saving you over $200. Check out www.astutegraphics.com.
Hey, my name is Diane Gibbs, and I'm the Creative South Volunteer Coordinator. I'm looking for a few more awesome volunteers. Do you like meeting new people and helping out? Do you like saving $100? Well, then volunteering is for you. It's broken into 3 2-hour shifts for a total of 6 hours. Can you pour beers? Can you check IDs? Can you run around and help backstage and in the green room? Just go to creativesouth.com/volunteers with an S and fill out the form. I will send you the coupon code for your $100 off. It's a ton of fun. It's my 5th year doing it. I hope you'll join me.
If you like the Creative South podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South podcast swag. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, a shout out on the podcast thanking you for your support, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please, help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Jason, thanks for joining me this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man.
So this is a long time coming. I should have had you on. It is a complete oversight that I have not had you on before this.
Yeah, man. What's up with that?
I have no good excuses. I just somehow completely forgot. And at some point, I think I actually thought I had you on. Just after, 130-some episodes, people start running together.
So, well, it felt like you should have, right? You know?
Yeah. I owed this to you.
I think so. I think that's fair to say.
So, well, let's dive right in after I've embarrassed myself there with that. And tell me, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in northern New Jersey. I was born in Rahway, and I lived in Roselle for quite a while. Not the best town, I have to say. And then we moved down to Point Pleasant, New Jersey, which was kind of a totally different atmosphere.
Yeah.
And then I graduated from high school there, and I hung around for a while, and I was doing kind of menial jobs, working at supermarkets and selling computers at Circuit City before they went belly up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I met my girlfriend at the time, Melissa, and we started living together. Then we moved out to Pennsylvania together for a bit. And, you know, we got married while we were out there, and now we moved down to Kentucky. So kind of been going all over.
Gotcha. Well, let's back up a little bit and get into some of the growing up stuff. And
sure,
what type of kid were you growing up? Were you an artsy kid, or were you more into sports, or were you, what type of kid were you?
It was actually a bit of both, which made things interesting. Because I was that nerdy art kid that was also pretty good at sports, but I was never a jock and I never hung out with the jocks.
Sure.
So I played soccer, basketball, baseball, ran track in high school. I had a lot of different things that I did, but I never really felt like I fit in with that crowd. But gotcha. Then like the art crowd was kind of more of like the anime kids and stuff like that. And that really wasn't my scene either. So I was kind of, I belong nowhere in high school and middle school.
Yeah. You definitely don't see the metal kids hanging out with the anime kids.
No, I mean, it's kind of odd watching somebody be pretty good at basketball wearing a Cannibal Corpse t-shirt.
This is
it's
true.
It's not something you expect.
This is very true. So, well, let's talk about that, because you're pretty big into metal. How did you first get into it? Somebody had to turn you on to that at some point, because that's it's not like you're going for the mainstream, you know, Metallica. Not that you have anything against Metallica, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my mom was into like kind of hard rock grunge stuff. Like she had a lot of Pearl Jam albums and Alice in Chains, and that's already getting a little heavy. But my cousin, my older cousin, Ben, he was starting to get into like Slipknot and Mudvayne, right? When that new metal craze was kind of happening in the late 90s, Korn, bands like that. And from there, I kind of just started going to CD stores and stuff when I was around middle school age. I would skip lunch and I would walk to the CD store instead to buy music instead of food. Because I love music so much. And I would just pick up stuff based on the album art. And I kind of jumped headfirst in. I got Sepultura's Chaos AD. That was the first album I ever bought. And that's like a really heavy thrash metal album. So, yeah. I mean, I went, you know, right into the deep end when I started getting into the metal stuff.
Yeah. And for people for the people listening, you can't see, but he's actually wearing a Sepultura t-shirt today.
I am. Subconsciously, I knew that would somehow come up. yeah. And you remember Napster when that was a big thing, too?
I have no recollection of Napster, and I never downloaded anything off of it.
Oh, yeah. Me neither. But when I did, sometimes the file names would be totally wrong. It would tell you it's something, and then it was something totally different.
Yes.
So I was looking for more Sepultura tracks, and, you know, this file said it was, but it happened to be that Cannibal Corpse band covering them. And I was like, wow, this is really extreme, like really heavy stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think just because it was so different than what I was hearing on the radio or, you know, with my friends or their parents, you know, it just kind of struck a chord with me. Like, wow, this is really unique and different. And I don't know. I've never really grown out of it. My mom thought it was going to be a phase. And here I am pushing 30, still wearing death metal shirts to work.
Hey, as long as you can get away with it and not look like you're trying to be a hipster.
Yeah. They might think I am.
As long as you're not doing it ironically.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things you mentioned when you were talking about that is you were picking stuff out based on cover art. Was there a, you know, specific thing that just struck your eye when you would see these covers?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was just kind of drawn to like, kind of like the darker, more evil album art, you know, because I was so used to seeing everything that was
bright and poppy.
Yeah, exactly. Like it was all like neon colors and sugary sweet and this like kind of saccharine sort of look to it. And when I would see, you know, this guy Travis Smith was one of my favorite album artists, and I could tell right away it was a Travis Smith cover. And any band that he worked with was great. So I started like informing myself through aesthetics and visuals what things might sound like.
Sure.
And now I could look at an album cover and I could tell right away, like, oh yeah, this will be good, or this will sound like this. Mm-hmm. Like I just kind of have this instinctual capability, I guess, to figure out what something's gonna sound like before I even turn it on.
How often do you get disappointed by something?
It's pretty rare these days.
Yeah.
Like for the most part, like I'm like, yeah, no. If they used that logo on that cover. That's probably not good. Gotcha. I don't know why. They say don't judge a book by its cover, but I do when it gotcha. Comes to music, and it's usually right.
Gotcha. So you're going through high school. You're picking up all these metal albums. You're doing both sports and art stuff. Are you taking as many art classes as you can at this point, like all the electives and stuff? Or
I was taking studio art. Mm-hmm. I never took the 3D classes for like sculpting or stuff like that. I just wasn't really into it. In high school, I thought I was going to be an architect, so I was taking a lot of CAD classes.
Okay.
I even went to an architecture school for a semester after high school. I went to Wentworth Institute of Technology in Boston. Mm-hmm. And it was a great school, but I didn't realize that draftsman was no longer a job. You had to be an architectural engineer. You couldn't just draw the plans.
Sure.
So that kind of crushed my hopes and dreams there. I'm not a math whiz in any sense.
Yeah, me either.
yeah, I got through algebra. I got through geometry, and I kind of maxed out there. Pre-calc kind of sunk me, I think.
Yeah, I think I got sunk around geometry and trigonometry. That was rough for me.
Yeah.
So you get out of high school, you go for a semester to architecture school. At what point do you start getting into doing design stuff? Because I know you said you worked kind of a lot of grunt jobs and selling stuff at Circuit City and, you know, the exciting world of retail.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of accidental. It was like through tragedy, I found my calling kind of thing.
Sure.
After my first semester, I came home for winter break and my mom had to have an emergency surgery on her heart and she ended up passing away during the surgery.
Oh, no.
And she was only 38. She was pretty young. So my brother was only 8 at the time. And I was like, man, I can't like go back to college and leave my 8-year-old brother here without his mom. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I kind of owed it to him to stick around. And so I went to a semester of community college when I was staying home. And I wasn't really liking anything there either. But during that time, I had made some friends that were in the music scene. There were guys that had local, you know, punk bands, hardcore bands. And they knew that I was kind of artsy from school. Like they knew me, but they didn't know me in high school. You mm-hmm. know, so like, oh yeah, you were that artist in high school. And I was like, yeah,
sure.
And they're like, hey, do you want to do our show flyers and our album art and, you know, band shirts and stuff like that? So I kind of just fell into it that way. And where I really started making a business out of it was actually on MySpace. Everybody wanted a MySpace layout for their band. And you know, times were good with that for a little bit.
Yeah.
And, but once that, you know, sunk and, you know, MySpace was gone, you couldn't customize things anymore. I was like, well, I guess I'll move into the merch world. Uh-huh. So it started getting me acclimated with, you know, screen printing processes and limiting your color palette. And after a while, I figured out I'd like the type that I was doing more than the graphics on the shit. And that's where the whole typography and lettering thing came about a couple of years back.
Yeah. Well, you and with, you know, typography and stuff, you have this very ornate style with a lot of your stuff. How did that come about?
You know, I never put it together till just this very moment, but I think it's kind of like the same thing that drew me to metal, like the more extreme variety of music. It's like the really technical, flashy guitar solos and intricate drum patterns and rhythms that I liked in metal. Like, I think that's kind of what I liked about lettering too, was like the really elaborate ornate stuff. I was like, man, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. It's not just like the standard stuff that you see everywhere else. It's not Helvetica. It's not, you know, I think it was just the novelty of it all.
Sure.
Is what really kind of drew me to it. And, just like when I tried to learn guitar, I tried to jump headfirst into this and learn the hardest stuff I could. I was like, what can be the most challenging, most elaborate letter that I can make? And I was not very good at it for quite a while because I didn't go through all the fundamentals and the building stages I should have.
At a certain point, you've got to start kind of teaching yourself based on actual principles to get to where you are. How do you start picking that up?
I think it's like a realization that maybe the crazy wild stuff that you're really drawn to might not be necessarily marketable or valuable in a sense, at least until you get really good at it.
Sure.
So I think like a back to basics approach is like what makes this typography functional? What makes it say something about the company or the band that you're doing this for? And, you know, I started trying to invest myself a lot in those companies that I was working with to really get a sense of what works for them. I feel like a lot of times we get caught up in trying to put our own style into something instead of doing something that's tailored towards them. So I'd say like the best thing to do would be keep the brand or the band or whoever you're working for first at the forefront of your mind. Like put your ego in the backseat kind of and your style in the backseat. It could be okay to like try to influence it a little bit or, you know, play to your strengths from time to time. But I think just like going back to the fundamentals of making sure that it fits them is really important.
Gotcha. And during all this, you start, I'm going to affectionately call it hoarding samples of different type. What was it that drew you to that?
Well, I think it was just I wasn't seeing that really decorative, ornate type that I really loved in most places. I don't think it became fashionable yet online. Mm-hmm. I think when I started getting into type and lettering, there were a couple people that were really influential at the time, like John Contino and Jessica Hish.
Sure.
And they had very particular styles, but it wasn't necessarily that Victorian ornate stuff that I really loved. And I was like, man, where can I actually see this and learn this? Mm-hmm. And I stumbled across this bookshop in Delaware called Oak Knoll Press, and they had some sign painting books from the early 1900s. They had the Atkinson's book, which is basically like the sign painting Bible, and Prang's Standard Alphabets, which is still one of my favorite books. And those two like opened me up to this world of these vintage type specimens and these samples. And ever since I've been wanting more and more, and that grew into what is now the lettering library also, where I take photos of these and make them into PDFs and sell like bundles of them and things like that. But it's just, it started as like a necessity. Like, how do I learn this? How do I find real life, real world examples of this and learn from it? So I was looking at it as an investment, something that I could learn from.
Sure. For people who aren't familiar with Lettering Library, kind of explain that to them.
Okay, so Lettering Library was something that was actually conceived at Creative South. I had a talk with Keith Tatum there. I want to say it was 2013 or maybe 2014.
2014.
Yeah.
Because it was my first year. I remember that.
Yeah. So we had this talk about the importance of preserving vintage ephemera and typography and, you know, how it could be valuable to the modern day designer. And I had already amassed this collection of maybe 60, 70 antiquarian books on the subject. So I was like, man, how could I share this with everybody instead of just hoarding it on my shelves for myself? Like, how can I make this available to all my friends and peers? And we had this idea, and I was like, hey, what if I made this a subscription service to where 4 books a month would go out to everybody and they can see it for $10 a month and they can share in all the knowledge that I'm getting from this stuff. Mm-hmm. And it did pretty well for a while. I've ran it for about 2.5 years through the subscription service, but eventually I stopped because either I was running out of content or running out of time because I was juggling too many different things. Yeah, I think it was a combination of the both.
Those pesky day jobs.
Yeah. Having a 9-to-5, freelancing, having a type foundry, doing this, it was just too much. Mm-hmm. That's why that Lettering Library mega bundle became a thing for everybody who missed a subscription or wanted everything at once. You know, they had the ability to get 130-ish books right at once. Mm-hmm.
And you know, you so with that, the mega bundle, you did that on your own for a while where it was just going out under you, and then at a certain point you partnered up with Dustin from Retro Supply. How did that come about?
Yeah, that's right. I did the mega bundle thing kind of on a whim, Black Friday of 2016. Mm-hmm. I was just like, well, you know, I haven't been doing the subscription for a while and I have all this stuff here and maybe everybody would want it if I just put it up for $50, and it sold like crazy. I couldn't believe it. Like, I thought I would maybe pull in $500 for the weekend or something like that, mm-hmm. but it pulled in a lot. And I asked Dustin, I was like, do you think your audience would be interested in this same product if we ran this sale again Christmas through New Year's? And he was like, I don't know, man. He's like, a lot of the stuff is like, you know, mid-century modern. It's like kind of like 50s, 60s graphics. Like, I don't know if my audience will really dig something from the 1800s, like early 1900s. He's like, but we'll try it. And it did really well over there too. And he was like, man, I was like, I was so wrong. Like, that was probably the best-selling product of the year in just that week. So I knew I was kind of onto something with that. And then I did it again this year. Then we even got to partner with Design Cuts for a bit this year, where we gave them like a best hits. It wasn't all 130 books, but it was like 25 really good ones.
Sure. So with these 130 books, how are you finding them? These don't just fall into your lap.
No, it's a lot of hunting and searching. I mean, a lot of it's from eBay. It's just kind of knowing the right search terms and things like that. You know, sure. I have alerts for like 70 different keywords.
Oh God.
It's like, you know, penmanship, ornamental alphabets, monograms, speedball books, you know, like everything that I could think of that pertains to this stuff. And, you know, I'll scroll through it once or twice a day and see what comes up. And
how much crap do you have to wade through to get to the gems?
Oh, so much, especially when I'm looking for just, you know, straight up alphabet books. I'm getting a lot of like these nursery rhyme alphabets, like these kids books from the 40s and 50s that are like, A is for apple. You know, it's not what I'm after, but 9 out of 10 of the books are that.
What specifically do you look for with these books? What is something that stands out to you that, you know, sets off the bells and whistles that gets you excited?
Well, I feel like now I've only been collecting about 3 or 4 years, I would say. So it's not like I've done this for a lifetime.
Sure.
But I do have a decent understanding of what books are common, even though they appear scarce or rare. Mm-hmm. You know, they will pop up a few times a month or a few times a year. Like, they're not that uncommon. So when I see something that I've never heard of and other signed book collectors have never heard of, I'm like, yes, I need this now because I might not ever see it again. So it's just like scarcity is one of the big things. And then, just like how pretty it is, honestly. Like, if the pages look beautiful, I'm like, yeah, I want that. I mean, it sounds simple to say, but that's really what kind of drives me a lot of the time.
That simple aesthetic that just speaks to you.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, that looks awesome. I want that. <That's>, like, same with, you know, poster art or anything else. You know, it's just drawn to the aesthetic of it and pick it up.
Not to get too deep into your business, but how much are you spending on these? Because some of these, especially when they're rare and on eBay, you can get into these bidding wars and they get expensive.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I've bought books that should have been, you know, $600 to $1,000 for $30, but sometimes I've also spent $500 on a book that maybe wasn't worth $500.
And what does your wife say then?
Well, I don't know. She's learned to accept it. Well, she knows that I do make some money off of it, so she's kind of okay with it. But, you know, my other collections, like buying records or posters or stuff, she doesn't see as much of a investment.
Yeah.
Which I tend to agree, although I still love it.
You know, you got to have hobbies for yourself, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So during this, I know you went through a brief time where you kind of got burned out and you were almost ready to hang your hat up. Walk me through that. What brought that about and how did you pull yourself out of it?
Yeah, that was, I want to say like the beginning of 2017-ish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd gone through multiple projects in a row where in my freelance career, I was just getting this soul-crushing art direction. Like, I felt like everybody was, you know, destroying, you know, this beautiful work that I was making. I was taking it really personally.
Far too many make it pop.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of make it pop, make my logo bigger. You know, it was just a lot of bad direction and it was all work that I wasn't really proud of. You know, I was trying, I was chasing payment way too much. You know, nothing was going right basically. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, I feel like too close to my work, too passionate about this. And it's like, it's killing me. I want to go back to something that's mindless almost. You know, I used to work demolition and construction too, just hitting stuff with sledgehammers 8 hours a day. I was like, I want to go back to that.
That's got
to
be pretty cathartic.
It is. And then you clock out at 5 o'clock and any other problem is somebody else's problem. You know, you get your money, you go home. But when you're running your own business, your brain's constantly on 24/7. You know, you're thinking, oh, I could be doing this or I should have done that. Or you like guilt yourself into feeling like you should be more productive a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think just that was really putting a strain on me. But I'm glad that so many people talked me out of it. I mean, I had like 150 comments on that post when I put it up on Facebook of everybody reaching out and encouraging me. And I'm sure you saw that too. Like, I know you commented on it. You encouraged me to keep going too. And Lenny did, and Diane and everybody that's part of the Creative South family was like, yeah, what are you doing? This is what you're meant to do. Why are you going to throw in the towel? Like, everybody feels this way from time to time. And once I kind of saw that and I realized it was like this, you know, shared experience, it wasn't like I was special or I was going through anything different. You know, it kind of like grounded me, brought me back to earth. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, maybe I'm just going through a cycle and bad part. And, you know, it got way better after that. I mean, like a month after I said I was going to quit, I got one of the coolest jobs I've ever got. I got to work with Walt Disney. Like if I threw in the towel then and I never got to do that, I would be kicking myself forever.
Yeah. Are you allowed to talk about what you did for them?
Yes and no. I mean, I was commissioned through an agency. Like, it wasn't directly from Walt Disney.
You still did work for Disney. Agencies.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, they used it in Disneyland. I did a lockup for a festival they have called Season of Light. Mm-hmm. They made me pull it from Dribble. Where they said, yeah, we don't want that up there. Like, that has to be through the agency. But they didn't do it in-house. They came to me for it.
Gotcha. Are you allowed to at least put it on your website and credit the agency?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't want the imagery up there, but they said that I could say that I've worked for them.
Okay.
So it's kind of like this weird thing where I sort of can credit myself, but not really.
Gotcha. Yeah. Politics.
Yeah. That's always fun.
So kind of backing up and getting back into this, you know, amidst the kind of getting burned out and all, you and your wife made a pretty fairly sizable life decision when you got a new job and that took you away from home. How did that come about?
Yeah, I was talking to Tim Jones, who's the creative director at Cornette, which is where I work now. We had done a project together a couple years back for A&W restaurants where they have these table numbers that they put out.
Okay, I didn't even realize A&W was still around. So,
yep. Yes, they are. It's funny. There's like this weird thing where they don't own the root beer, which is what everybody knows them for. Mm-hmm. Coca-Cola owns that. Mm-hmm. So they don't own the root beer, but they have restaurants and franchises and stuff. So we had did these table numbers, you know, 0 through 100. And we did these, you know, special designs for each number. And that project went really well a couple years back. And he's like, hey, you know, have you ever thought about working in-house somewhere? Like, we could use some more designers. And I thought it was kind of like this passive thing. And I was like, yeah, you know, sure, I'll come down there. I'll see it. And so I went down there. I met him. I walked through the place. And he's like, so you want to start next week? And I was like, yeah, I guess. So I went back home, packed everything up, and we came back down the next week.
Yeah.
And so I've been working a 9-to-5 since September 2016 now. And it's been a pretty cool experience. It's something totally different than freelancing. I feel like I went backwards from everybody else. Everybody goes to an agency and then they freelance. But I freelanced for 10 years and then went to an agency. I think I just wanted stability and benefits and an assured paycheck, which is really nice.
Yeah, health insurance is a good thing to have.
yeah, especially right now.
yeah. It's expensive, but it's good to have.
Yeah, and as you get older and you start wondering, what was that pain?
Dude, you're not even 30. You kind of
need it. I'll be 30 in September, but I have the body of a 90-year-old.
Oh, okay.
Everything's wrong with me.
There you go.
Cool. I have like that kind of Benjamin Button thing going on to where I look younger, but I feel way older.
Gotcha. You probably need to do what I need to do and start working out a little bit.
Yeah, I always plan on doing it. And then I think, well, I'll have to sweat and feel bad for a bit. And I don't want to do that.
That's how I talk myself out of it too.
Yeah, like I could go eat pizza instead.
Yeah. So with Cornette, what exactly are you doing there?
I guess technically my role is a graphic designer, so I'm doing everything from print ads to stuff for our clients' websites. But a lot of the time they just come to me as like a specialty resource for lettering. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on clients like A&W, Valvoline, our visitor centers called Visit Lex. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of work around the city in Lexington. Sazerac is another big one. We work with a lot of bourbon brands like Buffalo Trace and Weller and Wheatley Vodka. And that account's pretty fun.
Do you get samples to test out so you can, product research and know what you're looking for?
We do. And it's really nice. That's a good perk of the job. We actually get to go to the distillery a few times a year and get, our special tour through the place mm-hmm. and do these tastings. And they're pretty fun to work with, I got to say.
Gotcha.
I wasn't a bourbon and whiskey guy before I moved to Kentucky. I was more of a rum guy. But now that I'm down here, I've kind of switched genes.
Yeah, you got to learn to adapt.
Yeah. It's pretty easy to do when it's that good.
Yeah, this is very true. So you're kind of a specialist there working on lettering stuff and building that up. But on the side, you are still freelancing. Mm-hmm. Plus, you run a type foundry. Tell people about Carmel.
Yeah, so Carmel Type Company is something that I started with my friend Drew Melton back in like 2014, I want to say now. Mm-hmm. I had created this font called Skyward, and it was all just vector shapes. I had no idea how to actually make a font. Mm-hmm. So I had these shapes, and I was like, hey, Drew, I know you have been making fonts. Can you develop this for me? And he was like, yeah, sure. He's like, I'll turn this into a font. So we were splitting that 50-50. You know, I designed it. He developed it. And we're like, well, I have a couple more fonts that I need developed too. Like, do you want to make those too? And we had four or five of them to launch with. And since then, we were trying to get more artists on board. And we got these really amazing sign artists, Gary Godby, Noel Weber, Gary Berg. And we've talked to many more too about coming on board and selling their fonts. And now we've put up a library of maybe 30 or so fonts, I think. Mm-hmm. It's getting pretty close to 30. And we're actually looking to expand quite a bit this year with Carmel, too. We have plans of bringing some other people on board. I don't know if they want me to quite say just yet. So I'll leave it to be a little bit of a mystery. But we have a bit of a marketing wizard trying to come on board. And sell our stuff for us because we're really passionate about the design part of things, uh-huh. but not so much about the selling. Like once we make it and we put it up there, we're like, I'm burned on this. I've seen this font for 5 months straight. Like
I'm sick of it. Do something else with it.
Yeah. I don't want to see it again. Just somebody buy it or don't. But now we need somebody to come on and actually like push this stuff and start making it a little bit more profitable. And I think it's going to be really good when he comes up.
So with Carmel, and your love of a specific era and type, are you trying to stick to more that era or are you with bringing more people on board? Are you trying to kind of expand out and be a little more versatile?
I think we're looking to be a little bit more versatile. It definitely started as more of a, old timey font shop, but I think we just like to explore all areas of display type and not necessarily a single era. Mm-hmm. Like one of the newer fonts that I've put out was called Reverb and it was kind of like the 60s, 70s psychedelic rock looking font. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's a little bit different from what you'd expect from me, I bet. Yeah, we have some young guns that are coming on too that aren't these, older sign guys. We got some people in their, 20s, 30s coming on that have like a more of a fresher perspective, I guess, on type design.
Sure.
So we're going to get a wide array of different people selling with us, we hope. So I'm pretty excited for what 2018 has in store for Carmel.
Gotcha. How does that partnership with Drew work? Because he's based out of New Orleans, right?
Yes, as of very recently, he just moved back to LA. Like,
oh, okay.
In the last week or two.
Oh, I was about to say he was with Closer and Closer in New Orleans. And
Yeah. He started, Closer and Closer. And I think his wife works on it with him too.
Okay.
And, Yeah, he was doing that out of New Orleans, and he has a roster of 20 or so artists now that he's built up that he represents. And as of January 1st, 2018, I'm actually one of the artists he represents now.
How does that work out where he's your business partner in one aspect and he's your agent in another aspect?
Well, Drew has always been really good at managing relationships. And he's kind of like one of those type A personality people that will just like bang the door down to get you work and get people like noticing you. And I'm more of like a passive guy. You know, I never like cold call or cold email anymore about a job. You know, it's just if something comes in, it comes in because I have my 9-to-5. Like, I don't really need the freelance, but if something cool comes along, I'll take it. But he's out there like actively looking for stuff that I really want to do.
Sure.
Like book covers and liquor labels and things like that, that I think would be really fun to do. He's finding me that work. And because we had done Carmel together, we knew that we already worked pretty well together. There was a decent business relationship and that everything would go pretty smoothly.
Gotcha. Have you been able to leverage his relationships with anybody to help expand Carmel?
Yes, actually, he has a list of like 20 or 30 people that we're planning to do outreach with within the next month or two. And we're hoping to really broadly expand the Carmel library to, you know, from 30 fonts up to over 100.
Oh, wow.
This year.
That's a big jump in 1 year.
Yeah, it really is. But I think that versatility is what makes, you know, like other font shops so great. Like when you go to like Lost Type or, you know, like my fonts or even, you know, like those big distributors like that, like you can just get anything from there.
Sure.
We kind of want to be sort of in that same vein, but keep it with display type. Like we're not really looking for like text face kind of stuff. We still want it to be like more fun, playful kind of stuff.
Gotcha. Because I know, yeah, I know Drew represents Scott Biersack, who just started Continental Type with Winston Scully over the past year. So are you guys looking to do partnerships between things like that as well?
We haven't really discussed it yet, but I mean, I'm totally open to it. You know, Scott and Winston are also friends of mine. I took their workshop last year at Creative South, actually, the Type Cooker workshop. That was pretty cool. So, yeah, I think that's not something that's outside of the realm of possibility, especially since we kind of work together in a roundabout way now with Closer and Closer.
Very cool. What are your plans expand, you know, aside from adding all these fonts and the mysterious marketing help that you're getting that we won't we won't name drop on? What are your plans further down the road with it?
I don't know. I mean, like long-term goals have always been something I've struggled with.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think that our long-term goal is to position ourselves as one of the best places on the internet to go for display type. I feel like a lot of people consider, you know, like House Industries or Letterhead Fonts or Emigre, like long before they would consider us at the moment. But we'd like to be up there in that echelon, you know, within the coming years.
Sure. And then, you know, expanding past that with, you know, your other ventures with the freelance, with Type Library, with all of these things that you have going on, how are you balancing all of that? Because you do have a wife, and I'm sure she would like to see you and lecture you about your spending habits on your records.
Yeah. Well, I get to lecture her on her spending habits on animals too. She has quite the zoo, which I think you're sort of aware of.
Yeah, I am.
Snakes and geckos and lizards and whatnot. So she can't, you know, go at me too hard about that. You know, we have this mutual understanding. You get your animals, I get my records and books.
Maintenance costs are a lot lower for your stuff than for hers.
Yeah, see, that's the argument I always try to make. I'm like, I don't have to keep my books alive. You know, once I bought the book, I don't need to feed it and change its litter. But yeah, managing it has become easier over time. It was tougher when I was trying to make everything a full-time endeavor.
Sure.
You know, I was like, man, I got to, you know, dedicate 20 hours to this and 20 hours to that. But now it's kind of just as I have time. I think stopping the subscription service on Lettering Library really freed up time for me because I wasn't needing to find four books every month and shoot hundreds of pages and compile them into PDFs. You know, if I wanted to, I could do it, but I didn't have to anymore.
Sure.
And that was really relieving. And Carmel kind of fell by the wayside for a bit because I had sort of burned myself out on fonts. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to go back to more freelance gigs, and freelance has been the thing that's been at the forefront, I would say, of my work outside of the 9-to-5.
Sure.
I've been getting some pretty decent work. Last year I did a lot of stuff for Harley Davidson, which was really cool. Now I'm working on some stuff for a vintage antique shop in Texas. It's this lady and her husband. They've retired. They bought this old vintage 50s gas station. They're converting it into this Petroliana and like just this beautiful old car kind of place. And so they have like these gas pumps that have the porcelain tops and everything's restored perfectly. Uh-huh. And So I'm doing all of their branding and stationery at the moment. And then I have this bourbon place right in Lexington called House of Bourbon. I just did a branding project for too. They're going to be selling like really cool vintage bottles, like $15,000 bottles of stuff that you can't find anywhere else. You know, like sealed 1910 bottles of bourbon.
So did the collector and you have to restrain yourself from working out a trade deal on that?
A little bit.
Money is more important than a bottle of bourbon that I can never open.
Yeah, I should have negotiated like a tasting or something. At least. There
you go. Yeah, you can still ask for that on the back end.
Yeah, I'm sure it's like $500 an ounce or something.
Yeah,
crazy number like that. But hey, why not?
Just ask for an eyedropper full.
Yeah, that'll do.
Just put it on the tip of my tongue.
Just a little bit, just a touch.
I would pay money to see you trying to beg for like an eyedropper full of bourbon.
I think that would lead people to believe I have a problem.
True. So with all of this stuff going on that you're currently working on, what are some things that you're looking forward to?
I think I'm going to try expanding that Lettering Library mega bundle to upwards of 150 books in the coming months. I've gotten a lot of new good stuff lately.
You just need to do a Lettering Library Volume 2 so you have a second product line.
Yeah, that too. I mean, I've talked about doing ones where it's kind of specialized too into bundles. You know, like this one's just calligraphy. This one's just sign painting. This one's just alphabets. So I'm going to play with that a little bit this year.
It's a good idea. See what I can do. You should do that.
Yeah. Thank you. And I have a few fonts that are just about done too. So I have three or four more fonts I'm planning on releasing this year. And there is a really cool project that I have too at Cornette that I've been really excited about.
Yeah, what's that?
There's this historic courthouse that was built in 1899. Mm-hmm. And it's this beautiful, massive limestone place. And they're restoring it into an event space and offices and everything. But the Historic Preservation Society has been with them every step of the way, making sure it's actually accurate and correct to the time period. And it is beautiful. Like, they spared no expense. And they actually came to us for the branding. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be putting some typography that I created in these big three-dimensional cast bronze letters on these huge limestone slabs.
Oh, wow.
And then they're going to be engraving a couple of my fonts on these things, like 9 feet high. So seeing my work in that space is going to be really crazy. I've never had an opportunity quite like that.
Gotcha. Now, through this entire process of drawing out type and stuff, have you finally learned how to take it into like glyphs and do it yourself?
Oh yeah. Yeah. For the past like year or so, I've been developing all my own fonts. So like the new one, Botanist, that I just dropped, mm-hmm. that one was all me, Reverb was, and, I think Mosler was the first one that I did. That was like that blocky, safe looking one. I've gotten pretty good with doing that, and I've gotten a lot quicker with it too, mm-hmm. over the last year. You know, I started being able to notice and recognize that I could recycle components or parts from certain letters to build others, you know, like the left side of your O is going to be the same as the left side of your C and your G. Or, you know, like an A is basically an upside down and backwards V without the crossbar. So like you can flip things around and reuse components, and you can find all these relationships within letters that makes it easier than drawing 26 of them. You know, you can draw.
Gotcha. You're gonna have to give me some lessons on building my own types. I've got glyphs, and it just intimidates the hell out of me.
It did for me too for a bit. Luckily, you know, Drew helped me out a little bit when needed. Maddox too from Fort Foundry. He's been pretty supportive of everything that I've been doing. Uh-huh. He's actually the one who really got me interested in doing type first. My first Creative South, I think, he had a workshop. Uh-huh. First one in the morning, and he was talking about how to use glyphs. I was like, man, that looks really cool. Because one of the problems that, well, it wasn't really a problem, but it was more of like a workflow thing. Like I'd find myself drawing the same kinds of letters in a lot of projects that I had. And I'm like, it would be so much quicker if I could just type these out instead of redrawing the same kinds of letters every time.
Sure.
So it started out as like a necessity or like a more of a functional thing before it became more of a product idea.
Okay. That makes sense. So, excuse me. So as we're kind of getting close to our time here and wrapping up, you know, you've spoken at Creative South. You've done a few other speaking engagements. Is that something you'd like to pursue and do more of? Or is that terrifying?
It does terrify me a little bit, I got to say. And my speaking engagement that I had at Creative South was with a partner.
Sure.
I had Keith Tatum. So if I got stage fright or I got stuck, you know, I had somebody to kind of pass it off to, which was nice. And then this last year at Weapons of Mass Creation, I did a panel with a few people, and I had Dustin there with me on the panel. Mm. So it was kind of like not all the pressure is directly on you. I feel like doing a solo talk is a little terrifying. But it's not outside of the realm of possibility. I mean, I'm sure it could be done. I saw this quote recently. I want to try to get it right because I might be paraphrasing here, but they said, when you're in the ocean already, it doesn't matter how deep it is. So when you're out there, whether there's five people in front of you or there's 500 people, like you're kind of doing it. So it doesn't really matter who's watching.
Sure.
So I got to just kind of psych myself out of it. Brandon Reich helped me with that actually a lot.
Yeah.
At Weapons of Mass Creation when I did Ink Wars, because I was really nervous about Ink Wars too.
Were you?
Yeah. And he's like, listen, he's like, you just got to go up there. You got to think that you're the baddest motherfucker out there. You got to not care about anybody else. And like, he like hyped me up for it. And I was like, yeah, I could do this. No problem. You know, even though I was going against like, you know, awesome people like Derek Castle and James Flames, you know, OK Pants and all those guys, you know, he still made me feel better about it. And, you know, I had a great time. So I feel like all the fear is kind of unwarranted. You know, like once you're actually doing it and you're out there, it's not as bad as you think it is.
Yeah, I've never heard of anyone actually dying from stage fright. So.
No, not at all.
The worst thing that happens is you get a little nervous and you get a little clammy and might forget something you were supposed to say.
Yeah.
But you generally recover. So.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a little hard to come down to Creative South and speak. I mean, some of those people that I've seen up there, like, they look like they're pros at it. Like, their presentations are on point. Everything's so emotional and so well thought out. I feel like I'd go up there and just be like, well, you know, I make letters and stuff. Here's some of my letters. I don't even know what I would talk about.
Stop comparing yourself to them and think of what you would talk about. About what's important to you.
Death metal.
There you go. See, you could do an entire thing on typography and death metal.
I could really study that and turn that into a. I could probably talk for 40 minutes about black metal and death metal logo.
I've heard you do it. we had an entire conversation at Weapons of Mass Creation a couple years ago about logos in music.
Oh, yeah, our rooftop sessions up there at the hostel. Yeah.
I wish that had picked up on mic better, but it was so muddy you couldn't tell who was who and all the background noise.
Yeah,
that was
a bit windy up there.
That was a fun conversation, though.
So. Yeah, it was.
Cool. Well, Jason, where can people find you online?
They can find me on Instagram at instagram.com/JasonKarn or Dribbble is where most of my work can be seen because my website is still under construction. So dribbble.com/JasonCarn, or you can find me at carmeltype.co and letteringlibrary.com.
Cool. And we'll link to all this stuff in the show notes so people can find it as well.
Awesome. Thank you.
Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me, and go ahead and hug some necks.
Will do. Thanks for having me on, man.
Not a problem. You can find out more about Jason on Twitter at Among Villains, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Creative SO Pod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Creative South GA, or over at CreativeSouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. Astute Graphics currently have 25% off the full Elite Bundle, saving you over $200. Check out www.astutegraphics.com. For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at Patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.